From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In the midst of his war on Syria and a refugee crisis, and with more journalists in his prisons than any other nation on earth, the party of Turkey's President Erdogan, the Justice and Development Party, scored a major victory in Sunday's parliamentary elections, signaling a return to single-party rule in a country which has been otherwise deeply divided over security, social programs, and the direction of the economy. CCTV's Natalie Carney filed this report from Istanbul.
They are the results the AKP was hoping for, winning more than 49% of the votes and at least 316 seats in the Grand National Assembly. Turkey's Justice and Development Party, led by Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, has again secured victory.
Today is a day of victory for our democracy and for our nation. To all those and all the brothers who contributed to this victory, may God protect you.
Across the country, emotions ran high as the results were released. In June, the AKP, which has led the country since 2002, lost its one-party rule. After coalition talks proved inconclusive, Turks returned to the polls for the fourth time in just over 18 months.
I voted for AKP. I'm not like the new generation. I have experience. We washed our dead bodies. We got our water from the mosque. We live amongst piles of garbage. But the AKP has made our country paradise in the last 13 years. I vote because it is my duty as a citizen.
But others fear what a return to a majority AKP government could mean for the country.
Many people expect that the level of authoritarianism will increase in the country. The AKP government has been struggling with many oppositional groups, especially during the last 2 years, from the left, from the right, and now many people think that it will take the revenge in the country and this will increase the level of repression on the oppositions.
In December 2013, the AKP was entangled in a damaging corruption scandal and has been accused of cracking down on personal and press freedoms. Many also accuse the AKP of doing too much in Syria and too little against ISIL. Two bombings in Turkey linked to the terrorist organization have killed more than 130 people since June. Yet the AKP still captured votes from those who see it as being the only party powerful enough to bring security back to the country.
The main reason I'm voting is to bring peace to the country and relieve the pain.
Meanwhile, the main opposition Republican People's Party, the CHP, took about 25% of the vote, and the Nationalist Movement Party, the MHP, won just under 12%. Turkey's pro-Kurdish party, the HDP, managed to stay above the 10% threshold to stay in parliament, despite renewed fighting between the Turkish state and Kurdish separatists in the east of the country.
Turkey has a rough road ahead. The AKP may have won back its single-party majority, but the country still remains deeply divided on what its future should look like, haunted by insecurity from both within and outside its borders, an escalating refugee problem, as well as a decelerating economy. The promise of stability appears to be the only unifying factor. Natalie Carney for CCTV in Istanbul, Turkey.
But opposition parties said the security situation and tight government control of the press made the elections anything but free and fair. Press TV's Verini Akit filed this report from Istanbul.
When we talk about the security situation in the country, we have to understand that many Kurdish supporters had been killed in twin bombings in Ankara just 3 weeks before these elections on the 10th and the 10th of October. And so, and prior to that, since the violence erupted in the southeastern and eastern areas of the country, which is heavily Kurdish populated, there have been curfews in those areas, there has been a lot of violence in those areas, and many Kurdish people have actually been killed during that time. Since the last election and until now, this election on Sunday, the 1st of November, the HDP has also been a concerted campaign among various parts of the country to brand the HDP as the political wing of the PKK. And as you know, the PKK is a terrorist organization acknowledged by the European Union, the United States of America, as well as Turkey. And there has been harsh crackdowns on various media organizations, especially the media organizations which have been critical of the government.
And according to RT's William Whiteman, also reporting from Istanbul, there was outright ballot stuffing and fraud by Erdogan's party.
While we've been here, we have heard numerous reports of sort of wrongdoings and discrepancies when it comes to came to the voting. For example, a series of observers, volunteer observers, who each year have been able to observe the elections, they have been denied entrance to a large number of polling stations across Turkey. As well as this, there are reports circulating that something over 1,000 people have been arrested for making multiple votes. And pretty much for every single one of these cases, it is reported that the party they were voting for was the AKP, Erdogan's party. So that it does sound very suspicious. The votes were counted incredibly quickly, considering how high the turnout was for this election.
The first of the bodies of victims of this weekend's crash of a Russian airliner over the Sinai arrived in St. Petersburg Sunday, where forensics experts were set to examine the remains. RT's Neil Harvey has more.
Russian emergency ministry planes carrying the bodies of the crash victims have touched down at St. Petersburg's Pulkovo Airport. RT correspondent Ilya Petrenko has been waiting there for the arrival. Ilya, this is clearly a somber time for family and friends. What's happening there at the moment?
Well, I just saw that plane with my own eyes. It touched down at St. Petersburg's International Airport at exactly 5:53 a.m. As we understand from various reports, there could be about 120 bodies on that first plane. And if we count the time since the crash itself, it took them slightly less than 48 hours to bring the first victims' bodies back to St. Petersburg. Now, the next step will be bringing them to the city's crematorium. That's where the final identification procedures will take place. The relatives of the victims will be driven there on special buses, of course, accompanied by an army of doctors and psychologists, because the amount of stress that they're in for is, of course, beyond imagination. In the next few hours, 50 forensic doctors will be operating at the crematorium. The registry office will start issuing death certificates immediately, and the insurance papers are expected to be issued starting 9 a.m. local time, approximately that time. Every single family will receive compensation regardless of nationality and the region of residence. We're also expecting the arrival of the second emergency ministry plane, but that's not going to happen until Monday evening.
Of course, as well as wanting to mourn, many people will also be wanting answers. They'll want to know how this tragedy actually occurred. Where are we at with the investigation?
Well, I can tell you that the team of investigators is really working hard at this vast crash site on the Sinai Peninsula. They're getting all the necessary assistance and support from the locals and also Egyptian authorities. They will also be joined by a team of Irish experts later on Monday. Ireland was the country where the fatal Airbus was originally registered. Well, with all the effort that is being put into that probe, there's great hope that the reasons for that crash will be found. However, the Russian Foreign Ministry is saying that it's premature to make any conclusions on the reasons of the crash. And the Russian officials are also calling on everyone to have that strength and patience before this probe can be complete and concluded.
Many thanks to our correspondent Ilya Petrenko reporting there from St. Petersburg, where the first victims have been returned back home.
This past Friday, the U.S. announced that it is sending ground troops to Syria, despite repeated denials by the administration over the past several years that it would do so. For more on that, we spoke with our analysts Mark Sloboda in Moscow and Eric Dreitzer in New York. They appeared on this weekend's edition of CPR Sunday. Mark, let's start with you.
Well, of course, the big news out of Syria in recent days is the U.S. announcement that it would be sending ground forces. At the moment, it said those are restricted to special forces and advisors. not only to Iraq, where there are already nearly 5,000 U.S. troops on the ground that were engaged in combat operations this week. The White House continually tries to say they are not engaged in combat operations, but the general in charge of this says we were in combat. We are in combat. And then in Syria, as well, the U.S. announced that it would be sending a small number, vague, no specifics, supposedly less than 50, to aid and advise and coordinate airstrikes with the Kurdish forces in the north, but also with Arab allies, unnamed Arab allies. And I have seen some names floating around. We've already given this new proxy branding a snappy name, the Syrian Democratic Forces, hashtag SDF. And this is a number of supposedly FSA brigades that no one has ever heard of before that are suddenly popping up that total up to almost 10,000 forces, supposedly in northern Syria. No one knows where these comes from, but of course they're still dwarfed by the size of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Jaish al-Fatah in the neighborhood, and by the Kurdish forces that they are supposedly cooperating with, although there's no real indication of this, which number around 50,000. And they're stretched across almost all of northern Syria at this point, the Kurdish forces, except for a area where both the quote-unquote anti-Assad rebels and ISIS get their supply lines in and out of Turkey. Just last 2 weeks, the Kurds have attempted to expand to the west in what were some Arab-majority towns where they had previously driven out ISIS. This is threatening into this area to the west, which is essentially the center of northern Syria on the Turkish border, where the Turks open fire on the Kurdish forces in the town.
Let me jump in on that if I could. Sorry to cut you off there, Mark, but I just want to add something here. When you read the reports in the New York Times, for example, going back a number of months, they had long since talked about the creation of a joint Sunni, Arab, and Kurdish fighting force under the auspices of the United States, presumably. And what's really interesting about that, if you looked at the breakdown of what the U.S. had been proposing, it was something like 3,000 Sunni Arab fighters and 20,000 Kurds. Now, the attempt was to create a fighting force that was going to be capable of taking over Raqqa, which is ostensibly the capital of the Islamic State.
Now, and there's absolutely no indication that is happening. The Kurds
Hang on a sec, just so listeners know, Raqqa is in Syria. So what we're doing is talking about plucking a chunk of Syrian territory and handing it over to some U.S.-backed construct.
Right. Thank you. Yes. Raqqa is an important city in Syria. It is the heart of the seat of the Islamic State, so-called Islamic
State.
In Syria. Yes. And Raqqa is a major hub here and a center that the supposedly U.S.-sponsored anti-ISIS fighters were going to try to take. But every analyst who understands Syria knows that the Kurds are far less interested in these Arab cities like Raqqa than they are in not only defending their own territory, but in consolidating it, in creating a corridor that will connect the Kurdish enclaves near Kobani and the Kurdish enclaves near the Turkish border that are separated by this wide swath of territory controlled by the Islamic State. And this is a very, I think, simplistic strategy. strategic issue to understand, which the reason I bring it up is because it undermines the very narrative that the U.S. is proposing, that it is putting together this Kurdish Arab coalition force to fight against the Islamic State. I would argue that the insertion of these special forces in combination with this supposed fighting force that the U.S. is putting together is really just a cover. It is a pretext for the expansion of U.S. operations. When the U.S. says they're putting special forces on the ground, you should understand that to mean special forces have long since been on the ground, that this has already been happening, and they're only announcing it now. Moreover, that the role of those special forces on the ground is going to be to coordinate the various fighting forces that are already there. Now, who is already there? It is the so-called Free Syrian Army. It is the al-Nusra Front. It is these various terror groups that are on the ground fighting against the Assad government. So what we are seeing then, in effect, is the U.S. escalating its coordination and command and control of the terrorist forces on the ground.
That are fighting the government. And this happens within the context of the peace talks that, you know, were in Vienna yesterday and the day before, and essentially is obviously an attempt to secure real estate so that when they sit down at the table, they're sitting on top of the ownership of a piece of real estate. One of the contradictions that you made reference to is this. Is the United States promising the Kurds a Kurdistan in Syria, and how does Turkey feel about that? And in fact, how does Iraq feel about that?
Well, and can I just say that the idea of embedded in your question, I know you were addressing to Mark. I'll let Mark go in a second. I just want to add this point. The question is not only whether the U.S. is offering a Kurdistan. What needs to be discussed also is the fact that Assad has basically said that the Kurds have some degree of autonomy and self-control over their own territory. So the issue for the Kurds, from my perspective, is where are they going to get the better deal, and what kind of a future Kurdish territory are they looking to build? Are they looking to build one that will be essentially a proxy and client of the United States, which is ultimately what the U.S. will be offering on the table to the Kurds? I think that's beyond question. Or are they looking for some kind of a truly independent Kurdish state that is going to actually be able to take on its regional enemies such as Turkey? Because it will not be able to do that if it is under U.S. auspices.
Go ahead, Mark.
All right. I think it's really necessary to take a look at this Kurdish question in detail. Now, there is a love among the Western left, I think, to perhaps to over-romanticize the Kurds, the Kurdish cause a bit, because, you know, their political and military forces, whether we're talking the PKK in Turkey or their analog, the YPG and the Social Democratic Party, its political wing in Syria, are, you know, to a large extent, still Marxist-Leninist, even. There's a degree of dogma there.
Anarchist.
Anarchist. There have been attempts over the week, to once again slur them as a cult and so on.
But you know what? I hear that, and that's all over the left here all the time, that kind of stuff. But to me, what cuts the mustard is not ideology, no matter what you publish or what tracks you issue or whatever, but rather where you stand in the geopolitical game. And so where do they work there, Mark?
Yeah.
Well, that is a question that is up in the air, because the Americans have. The Kurds during the Cold War era were obviously, aligned to some extent with interests with this from the Soviet Union, but during the Iraq decade, the decades of U.S. hegemony, the Kurds in the Iraq became the biggest and most loyal clients of the United States, and they essentially have their own little autonomous region in Iraq and have long since moved away from such Marxist, Leninist, any type of leftist background. And they've consolidated a little microstate there, and if Iraq continues to go south, know, the United States will eventually plant a Kurdish flag in Iraq. While those in Syria are more of a leftist bent, as are in Turkey. Let's not forget that there are also Kurds in Iran.
Yes.
Now, the Kurds are the largest minority in the world without a nation state of their own. And there's, of course, a lot of people that would say that they deserve one. And I have to admit that, when looked at it from a certain perspective, I agree with that. And then there's the question of the whole bloody ideology of nationalism and the idea of the nation state, this right. peculiarly European ideology, which has spread to a large portion of the world. How much blood and suffering it has caused, far more than capitalism or communism, I would argue.
Yeah.
And whether that's actually a goal that we should be looking for or not. This idea that the borders of a political state and the ethnicities within them should be congruous in order to establish a coherent political democracy where the biggest identity is not based on ethno or religious divisions, but instead on class and culture wars and other things, rather than these much larger differences. Now, we have seen some foreshadowing of this earlier this week. Remember, always the Kurds in Syria and Turkey, because they're essentially the same, are acting first and foremost in their own interests. They want, at the very least, an autonomous, if not independent state, which they are already calling Rejava, I believe, out of this. They want to consolidate this territory. Who can blame them? There are reports from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International that they are cleansing what were some Arab-majority towns in territory they're expanding into of Arab peoples that they said were loyal to the Islamic State. Now, of course, there's no real way to verify a lot of this on the ground, but and there are other Arabs that are supposedly aligned with them to some extent or another, although I think we have to question a lot of this. We have to imagine that some of this ethnic cleansing to make a Kurdistan state in Syria a real thing is going on. Again, we can leave aside the question of whether that's a good or a bad thing, because they have been fighting to a large extent on their own for survival against ISIS that has been, created at the very least through the willing negligence of the West and the almost certainly the connivance of their GCC allies over the last few years. And anyone who's been paying attention to the battles of Kobani and, of course, its romanticized female fighters, you can't help but have sympathy for them because they have done an amazing job of defending and expanding Kurdish control of their own territory with very limited resources in the face of bombing by Turkey and attacks by ISIS, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. Now, they form a organized military force and advance on Raqqa and take Arab, a large portions of Arab-majority territory? That I doubt, and I think they understand that. I think instead they will seek to join their eastern and western enclaves together across all of northern Syria, and that is a threat to the supply lines of ISIS and the other quote-unquote rebels.
Eric, hang on one second. Yeah. Before you go there, and I'll pose this to you, Eric, first, but if you want to defer to Mark, then we'll make the time up later. What you just described in terms of the military situation is going to hang essentially on how the air support develops, who it comes from, and the limitations of it. And there's obviously a competitive game going on between Russia and the United States. Somewhere in the back room, they're talking about that game. If the United States and Russia were both to say, we will give you aerial support, the situation of the Kurds on the ground improves tremendously, obviously. So yeah. How do you think that's going to play out?
Let me just go real quick on that, and then Eric can take over for a good chunk. This is the really interesting thing, because both Russia and the United States can work with the Kurds. And even the Syrian government, several years ago already, Assad gave autonomy to the PKK to, saying, you're on your own, see if you can hold that territory. And if we come out of this, we'll talk about whether it's autonomy or independence or whatever later. Because the Kurds are secular, so the Russians and the Americans can both talk to them. The problem is that Turkey, of course, doesn't want the Kurds, because it would lead into chunks of Turkish territory likely joining as well. So that is a direct contradiction with U.S. policies. The U.S. needs their Turkish air base at Incirlik, which they are now expanding, to continue operations in the area. Also, the Iraqis don't want this, right? Because they don't want their Kurds joining with the Syrian Kurds and breaking off from Turkey. The Iranians don't want this, because they also have a Kurdish minority too. So this is one of the most complicated international tangles in this whole
thing. Let's complicate that one step further. Because all of those groups don't want that. But if this becomes the only viable alternative to that little Sunni statelet that breaks up the arc of the Shia, might they all go for it? Eric, I'll start with you. We go to that.
Well, yeah, let me get to that in a minute. But I have a couple of things I want to add to Mark's analysis here. Number one, and people who don't follow this stuff might not realize this entirely, but there are very clear differences between these different Kurdish groups that are in these various countries. And what Mark was talking about in terms of uniting all of these groups is complex, because there is a major difference between the Kurds of northern Iraq and the Kurds of Syria and the Kurds in Turkey, for instance. In northern Iraq, the reason why the Kurds have gone all the way with the United States through the war period, through all of its machinations in Iraq, is because the Kurds of northern Iraq are controlled by two dominant families, the Talibanis and the Barzanis. And the Barzanis and Talibanis basically control northern Kurdish Iraq as more or less a fiefdom to be divided up among themselves, as we know, of course.
Clan politics.
Clan politics, exactly. The Barzanis and the Talibanis, which have sat in the presidency and in the premiership in northern Iraq from time immemorial, as far as modern contemporary politics goes. And they are closely aligned with the United States, with Western oil companies, and with Israel. Seymour Hersh has written extensively about this during the Bush administration, why the Kurds were always going along with U.S. plans, why the Kurds were so deeply connected with Israeli intelligence, how the weapons have gotten into northern Iraq through those two main avenues. And so that element of the Kurdish question is decidedly different from the Kurdish population, the Kurdish territory in Syria, which is much more, you know, this Rojava non-state state, I guess we could call it, that has been operating, which is loosely aligned with leftist politics, community-based non-state organization, anarcho communist model, what have you. I mean, the ideology is complicated. I know that they're the leadership read Murray Bookchin, who's an anarchist, but they also read typical Marxist-Leninist stuff, so I don't want to get into that part.
Let me ask you just one quick thing about that. Okay, these two families, if you look at the entire possible Kurdistan in Turkey, Iraq, you know, everywhere there, Iran and Syria, how large a portion of that, not in terms of real estate, but in terms of like people and potential wealth, do these two families own?
Well, they will to a large extent influence the future of a Kurdistan, because they have Mosul. They are they are Kirkuk. They have the major oil wealth of northern Iraq. There is a major source of revenue for them, and if they're normalized, you can bet that the Talibanis and the Barzanis between them, if they don't totally control a future Kurdistan, will control vast portions of it and will be very, very influential. And this is part of the reason why the U.S. and the Israelis and their allies have been more or less behind the Kurdish minority here and pushing for, if not pushing for a Kurdistan, at least pushing for increased autonomy for them. Remember, there was this one of the major sins, quote unquote, of former Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq was that he refused to allow the Kurds to sell their oil directly to ExxonMobil and to BP and to Royal Dutch Shell and to all of the Western oil majors. They wanted to basically go around Baghdad and sell directly to the West. And Baghdad said, no, you're part of Iraq. You go through Baghdad. Right. And that was one of the major reasons why the U.S. wanted to get rid of Maliki, that sort of nationalist assertiveness.
Yes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.